Of all the crimes that I investigated, she is the most evil person that I've ever met.
I think every day there were beatings. Some of the beatings were very vicious. I'm quite surprised that people survived them.
She had me under LSD for days. She'd just come in like every 12 hours or so and give me another piece because I wasn't working hard enough.
These are some of the 28 children collected by cult leader Ann Hamilton Byrne.
She wanted us to be the new race of children, these perfect children who would save the world.
I had to start it. That was the divine vision.
That was a clip from New York CBS Channel 2. Just a hint of what we would be covering in this episode. We have heard of cults using psychedelic drugs in the past, but this one involves LSD being used on children. And when children are involved, that's a whole different level of abuse. And so, as with many other episodes, trigger warnings abound ahead. So please take care while listening as we learn about the family cult out of Australia.
Some children came from highly questionable adoptions, unwed mothers tricked into giving up their babies. Investigators say a few were out and out stolen at birth. Anne denies it all.
For more than 30 years, this is the only glimpse the world has had of Australia's most secretive cult leader, Anne Hamilton Byrne.
Look.
To her followers, she is the reincarnation of Christ. To the children she beat and abused, a monster. Now, for the first time, Anne Hamilton Byrne has agreed to talk. And then, there was the most terrifying ordeal of all.
They put a bucket here, and then one of the aunties would help, and then you'd have to kneel down, and then they'd push your head into the bucket and hold it for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, then bring it out again and say, did you do it, did you do it? Say, no. Back in again.
Water torture?
Yeah. Because Anne had said better to be drowned than a liar, basically.
Better to be drowned?
Than be a liar.
Peter Van Zandt joins us now live. Peter, does this cult still exist?
It does. The family exists in Australia and also up in Hurleyville, New York. That house that you saw on tape there, we actually were shooting out there, and a fellow pulls up and he says, what are you guys doing here? And I said, we're doing a story about a cult. And he goes, it's not a cult. And he peels out and goes into the driveway.
The photos of those involved, voluntarily or otherwise, in this group are striking. The leader, Anne Hamilton Byrne, looks like a movie star. In other photos of the group, handfuls of children wear all black and don blunt bleach blonde bobs and bangs. It's downright creepy and somewhat Andy Warhol-esque. Before yoga instructor Anne founded the family cult in 1964, she was Evelyn Edwards, born in 1921 to a young mother who eventually died in an asylum after a paranoid schizophrenic diagnosis. She was the oldest of seven children and spent much of her childhood in orphanages and left life behind as soon as she was old enough to, changing her name in the process. And her tragic life continued when her husband died in a car accident shortly after Anne gave birth to their first child. Later, her daughter suffered compound fractures to the base of her skull after a major car accident, and Anne alleged that her daughter walked out of the hospital within a week of the accident because of her, quote, spirit help and prayers, end quote. Anne then took up yoga, drawn to the connections it had to Eastern religion and New Age mysticism. She was a stunning, well-dressed, wore Chanel perfume, and had a propensity for the charismatic to match her magnetic personality. She developed a reputation among those in Melbourne seeking spiritual enlightenment and would later charm many of them into following her. One former member, Fran Parker, claimed Anne's deep gray blue eyes were the primary source of her power. She said, In ancient times, we hear about enchantresses who could enslave people with one glance. She had eyes that looked through your soul. Another member that was charmed into following Anne was Joy Travelin, who came from a well-respected Melbourne Jewish family. Her father had rescued hundreds of Jews from Germany during World War II. Joy would later find herself in a failing marriage and suffering from severe whiplash after a car accident. She was advised to try yoga, which is where Anne came into the story. Anne convinced Joy to skip going to the hospital for exploratory surgery after she was bedridden and in constant pain. And the rest, unfortunately, is history. Within 6 weeks of Anne's intense prayer, Joy was up and walking and took on the name Naoma Hamilton Byrne. In 1961, Anne and new romantic interest Bill Byrne met a physicist named Dr. Rainer Johnson, who would go on to call Anne unquestionably the wisest, the sternest, and the most gracious and generous soul I've ever met. He was a well-respected headmaster of Queen's College, a university in Melbourne. Anne and the doctor began to experiment with LSD together and found themselves in the social circles of prominent Melbourne figures, other doctors and lawyers, for example, who turned to the yogi for guidance. She, in turn, provided them with a religious and philosophical discussion group that would meet in the doctor's living room every week and practice yoga and meditation. Dr. Johnson began to recruit people to attend Anna's group meetings and discussions, including several patients from a private psychiatric facility, New Haven Hospital, that was operated by members of the family. These patients were subjected to electroshock therapy and heavy doses of LSD, as well as leucotomies, the removal of white nerve fibers within the brain. The yoga and meditation meetings transformed into events that would take place on the doctor's property, known as Santakin, and on the outskirts of Melbourne. A lodge was erected as a sort of headquarters to house group sessions that consisted of Anna delivering her gospel comprised of Hindu, Buddhist, and Christian philosophy. In the early aughts, the group mainly consisted of middle-class professionals interested in Eastern mysticism, not flower child hippies. Here's a clip from 60 Minutes Australia.
Anne's followers included dozens of respected middle-class professionals, doctors, nurses, lawyers, teachers, all willing to do the bidding of their master.
I was told to leave my first wife and go up to the hills. I did. I was told that I would be going to have a baby with another woman, and I did.
Anne began collecting children at her hideaway at Lake Hilden near Melbourne. Her devoted followers able to convince unsuspecting teenage mothers to hand over the babies.
Not only was she smashing principles and ideologies from various religions together, but she entranced followers with her claims that she was a deity at the same level of Buddha, Jesus, and Krishna. Her ideology evolved into beliefs that World War III was imminent, and she was determined to prepare her followers for the unavoidable apocalyptic type war, while at the same time constructing a sort of master race. While under the influence of LSD, Anne decided her mission was to adopt dozens of children to save them from this apocalypse. Before it was known as the Family, the cult was also called the Great White Brotherhood and the Santa Catan Park Association. That is a hard word to say. Like many that came before her, Anne was convinced after another vision a la LSD that she was actually God. She would go on to claim that she was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ himself, and we've seen this so many times before, and was able to convince her followers to give her absolutely everything, all of their money, their children, and their homes. Literally everything, including the kitchen sink. She began her adoption spree by first targeting and shaming young single mothers from wealthy families who handed over not only their cash, but their children. Through this method, Anne was able to illegally adopt 14 infants and young children to help her prepare for the upcoming apocalypse. It was seen as some sort of honor to have your babies chosen for a master race, according to the family documentary, and in the 1960s and 1970s, adopting children from unwed mothers was fairly common. Filmmaker Rosie Jones told ABC Australia that, quote, older social workers would convince these young girls quite forcibly to give up their babies. The mothers would go into the birthing room, they would be given massive doses of drugs, A pillow in some cases would be put over their faces so they never saw their babies, and their babies were handed over. It is so sad. And Anne doesn't even know how many children over the years were adopted this way.
Bleached hair, blonde, singing like the Von Trapp family, living out Anne's fantasy of, in her thoughts, I'm sure it was something like an Aryan race. Horrific.
Even Anne claims she doesn't know how many children she acquired this way.
So how many?
I can't tell. I don't know.
You don't know? Dozens?
No. I only know mine.
How many of them were yours?
Altogether, I had 9 children.
Even that is a lie. What we do know is that eventually Anne would have up to 28 youngsters under her control, guarded by a sinister group of her disciples known as the Aunties. The children's very existence a secret.
This went on for nearly 20 years. At its peak, the family consisted of 500 devotees who were scammed and brainwashed into handing their children over to her. In the early 1970s, the group had started to procure older adolescents, and she raised them as her own, insistent that they were part of the self-proclaimed master race that would save the world. But the children lived on a separate, isolated property in Lake Ellidon, approximately 3 hours from Melbourne. They were sheltered, isolated, behind barbed wire fences and big brown gates, with signs warning trespassers that they would be prosecuted. Handily enough, the kids' compound was bordered on 3 sides by a lake that was often frequented by summer vacationers, though the children were so used to staying quiet and out of sight, they were never found. They weren't leaving, unless they were with a chaperone. But they didn't know any better. To them, this was normal. They knew nothing else, no other way of life. And despite the group's isolation, 2 registered teachers were allowed on the children's property twice a week to teach the kids, which seems like odd cult behavior. And even odder that the things the teachers likely observed and potentially witnessed were never mentioned to authorities. The property was also inspected by a representative of the education department, and shockingly, it passed. In 1982, it was listed with the education department as a private tuition center. The inspector at the time stated that the children were well cared for, wore well-clothed uniforms, and that their educational standards were higher than normal for their respective ages. But he did tell a publication called The Age that he felt that there was something strange about the setup. An article from 1987 stated that the children were, quote, regimented like the Von Trapp family of The Sound of Music, and each child, when asked for his name or her name, immediately volunteered a date of birth. The officer said that while he had misgivings, there was nothing which could be pinpointed to recommend to the registration should be refused. One of the rare freedoms the children had was access to a library of books, many on the subjects of World War II and concentration camps. Lee, that's weird. Was this to make them grateful for the life that they have, showing them it could have been much worse? I don't know. Or brainwash them into thinking an apocalyptic war was coming soon? I don't know. One survivor, Ben Shenton, recalled to the New Zealand Herald that Anne once allowed some of the older girls to attend a dance class, and their eyes were opened to how other children lived. They came back to tell their peers about sleepovers and parties. They then became aware of how different their lives were. And the World War II anthologies, they were beginning to make an impact. Quote, I would have been around 10 when we began to refer to the cult compound as the concentration camp. My home, from my earliest memories up until I was 15 years old, he said. It is estimated that 28 children in total were held captive by Anne on the outskirts of Melbourne, the organization's home base. Not all of the children were related to members of the group. Some were stolen or falsely adopted through adoption scams thanks to the help of the organization's doctors and nurses. It seems she continued to target unsuspecting unmarried mothers shortly after giving birth, and any legal paperwork could be processed by lawyers and social workers within the group, which is absolutely terrifying. These stolen kids were given falsified birth certificates and new identities with the last name Hamilton Byrne. Anne did claim to have given birth to many of the children and would even wear pregnancy clothing to feed the narrative. And when you see the photos of these kids, it looks like something out of a horror movie. Matching outfits, usually black, and the short cropped, primarily platinum blonde hair. A clip from a documentary called The Family showed Anne explaining that she wanted the children to look like brothers and sisters. She said, "I must admit this," she said. "I loved them in their little smocks and jeans and the hair and ribbons. It was beautiful. It was lovely to see." But behind their facades, these poor innocent children were starved. They were beaten. Beaten orders given by the women who had been taught that not only their biological mother was their Messiah, but the Messiah, and to add to the horrors, she would also have them injected with LSD and force them to endure long medical experiments. Children were given a cocktail of medications like antipsychotics, antidepressants, and benzos, medications that were typically given to medicate schizophrenics. I wonder if this had anything to do with losing her mother to the same diagnosis. Was Anne trying to make some sense of it, or make some sort of amends, or I don't know. And of course, Anna denied all of these allegations in an interview with 60 Minutes Australia.
Were the children ever hit?
Of course they weren't.
Because?
They were not beaten.
Never?
Never. You'll have to be pretty good to see through that bullshit. It's absolute bullshit. It's lies.
But this is to be no ordinary interview.
It didn't happen. It hasn't.
No, no. But what about if they went?
Well, that's crucial, isn't it? That's crucial. I don't abuse my children.
Now, yes.
Some of the sect members aren't happy about our presence.
As far as I'm concerned, you're living a lie.
Because your entire life is a network of lies.
And less happy still that children of the sect are fighting back, demanding the truth finally be told about their brutal treatment at the hands of Anne Hamilton Byrne.
Female cult members, referred to as aunties, were responsible for grooming the children to look as identical as possible. Sarah Moore, who was adopted by the cult from her 15-year-old mother at birth, told the Mirror that, "I think one thing that she wanted was lots of little children, little perfect children, in perfect little dresses with perfect little blonde hair." Friendships between the children were forbidden, and those who formed relationships were quickly separated from each other. The family was clearly anything but. And trigger warnings for the abuse I'm about ready to describe here. According to survivors, if a child were to act out, and I'm sure even if it was just for a minor offense like getting their clothes dirty or... And in these instances, if Anne herself wasn't available to dole out the punishment, she would have the child beaten by one of the aunties and would listen over the phone. Some of the victims recalled being beaten with the heels of stilettos. Some recalled having their heads held down in a bucket of water until they stopped thrashing and other forms of water torture. Fingers were held over flames. Valium was regularly dosed to keep children in line and docile until they turned 14. Sometimes the punishment would lead to compliance, and sometimes the punishment would lead to rebellions and end in even more brutal beatings. Anne called these accounts lies, though.
This is from Sarah's book. "Anne had a stiletto-heeled shoe in her hand and she started hitting me. A stiletto-heeled shoe. On my bare backside with the shoe, after about 20 or 30 hits, she got tired and Bill took over. He hit me with his hands. My head kept hitting the wall and I saw tears." Is she making that up?
You know quite well they can.
They can what? Make things up?
Kids can make things up. We've all been kids.
You were a monster at times.
I have nothing to say because I don't feel like one.
Are you a monster?
I'm not conscious of what you're saying I should be conscious of.
Are you a monster?
Certainly not.
Are you evil?
Well, what do you call evil?
The systematic abuse of children is evil.
Once a child reached puberty, some claimed they had to suffer through an initiation ceremony fueled by drugs. The child would be left alone in a pitch-black room for days on end after being given a dose of LSD, that sounds so scary, and were only allowed to be visited by Anne or one of the psychiatrist members of the cult. And unfortunately, Anne got away with this abuse for decades, until a rebellious teenager put an end to her madness. Remember Sarah that we quoted earlier in this episode? Well, Sarah remains a bit of a legend after unfortunately losing her life at the age of 46, after suffering long-term mental and health problems as a result of her abuse. But she did leave a legacy. After being raised from birth in this cult, at the age of 14, she was expelled for rebellious behavior. And what did she do? Thankfully, she went to the police. And the abuse that she suffered in her time there, there are no words. Survivor Ben, who was handed over to the cult as an 18-month-old baby, described how violently Sarah was beaten in the documentary. And trigger warning here. Sarah was thrashed. I was watching her being belted with a buckle, and she was beaten to the point where she was wriggling out of her clothes. Hearing her body smash across the balustrades, it was horrendous to know they had the power to do what they did. He explained that the children were to be unseen, unheard, unknown. And if they were noticed for poor behavior, there were consequences. But thankfully, Detective Lex DeMann not only believed Sarah's claims, but went so far as to persuading his supervisors to set up a task force because he believed that they were looking at not just a community welfare type issue, but a criminal one. And thus, Operation Forest was born. Though they were allotted very limited resources to deal with what would become a very complicated case. When the compound was raided in 1987 by more than 100 police, children ran in fear because they didn't realize their childhoods were filled with torture. Instead of running towards safety, they screamed and tried to fight off the rescuers. They ran for hidden tunnels that they would escape to when unannounced visitors arrived at the property. Their efforts failed, though, and the children, ages 12 to 17, were taken from the compound to safety by authorities. But those who stayed behind refused to be interviewed, let alone testify before the Royal Commission. Even the children that were rescued felt unable to testify against their mom. Evidence recovered on the scene included scores of prescription and non-prescription drugs, LSD, passport, and photographs. Ben, who was 15 at the time, would later tell SBS News that, "I saw the police or those strangers turning up saying, 'We're here to rescue you,' as a serious imposition, ruining the future I had." He thought he and his siblings were about to be brutally beaten yet again. But he thankfully realized that this was not the case, and that this was his ticket out of the life he was living. I'm happy to also report that Ben went on to get married and have two children of his own. Anne and Bill, who had married by this point, escaped the storming of the compound. Anne was overseas, and though Bill was present during the raid, he was not charged. Shortly after the raid, he flew to Hawaii to meet up with his wife, and somehow the couple dodged authorities and potential prison time for 6 years while on the lam, despite a warrant being issued for Anne's arrest and extradition back to Australia. What the rescued children went through, I can't even fathom. One of them later sued Anne in 2007 for cruel and inhumane treatment, including beatings, being locked in a non-temperature-controlled storage shed overnight, forced medication, including LSD, and insufficient food. Anne and Bill were finally tracked down in the summer of 1993, after a joint effort by Interpol, the FBI, and police in the UK, Australia, and the US got together. The couple was found in a tiny town in the Catskill Mountain region of New York State, and arrested and extradited back to Australia. They were charged with conspiracy to defraud and to commit perjury due to falsely registering the births of three unrelated children as their own triplets. Unfortunately, though, due to lack of testimony from victims and despite years of investigations, there was never enough evidence to charge anyone associated with the cult of child abuse. When Detective DeMann learned the pair had been arrested, he told the Weekly, "I walked out of the room and I broke down for about 10 minutes. I threw chairs everywhere because that was 4 years of memories of the police officers who'd been damaged by it and the pressure they'd been under to move it forward and get it done, and the admiration I have for the survivors, the children who came through what most of us would find absolutely abhorrent way of growing up. It all came out in that moment."
It was an incredible story.
Lex DeMann, a former detective, spent years tracking Anne down when she fled Australia.
Anne Hamilton Byrne is the most evil person that I've ever come across.
A case that unfolded in Australia came to its dramatic conclusion outside this house in the Catskill Mountains in Hurleyville, New York.
I'm amazed that we were actually able to find her.
FBI Special Agent Hilda Kogut rode around with the mail carrier.
Everybody knows that the mailman knows all.
To confirm the cult leader was there.
I knock with force on that door.
What do you say?
I say, FBI, open the door.
Anne tried to gain sympathy from authorities by pleading that she had a serious heart condition, but Bill convinced her to return to Australia after one of his cellmates was murdered. Upon her return, she hired a legal team that managed to fight the charges all the way to the Court of Appeals. The maximum penalty she faced was a $60,000 fine and a six-month jail sentence. Court proceedings were drawn out due to the sheer media circus that surrounded this case. In the end, Anne pleaded guilty to just one charge to avoid jail time. And in spite of multiple police investigations, she was only fined $5,000 for making a false declaration. Bill was also fined $5,000 and served almost no jail time for kidnapping and drugging children. Two of the cults imprisoned 28 children were able to receive compensation from Anne in 2009. Other victims' pursuits at financial reparations fell through after Anne was diagnosed with dementia. The condition rendered her unable to face further court action brought forth by survivors of her abuse in the last years of her life. And tragically, several of the survivors sadly died by suicide later in life. Bill died in 2001, and when Anne died at the age of 98 in 2019, her estate was still worth somewhere between $6 and $10 million from property and money given to her from her cult followers. The family compound itself sold for $1.2 million in December of 2021, and she died in a suburban Melbourne nursing home while receiving palliative care and suffering from dementia. She was buried next to Bill without a public funeral and without a headstone, and she never admitted guilt to any of her crimes. Remember the detective who led the case at the time? Detective LeMann? And yes, I would agree he was DeMann. Said this woman left behind a trail of broken lives, ruined people. The normal reaction where you receive the news of the death of someone is sadness. It's quite the contrary for me. The lives that she affected and her evil deeds, I shed no tear, not one drop. And I'm not sure that I would shed a tear for her either. She never even expressed remorse for her crimes. According to an article in The Mirror, when once asked why she started such a cult that subjected children to shocking abuse, she replied, "Because I love children." And that is the story of the family cult. Thank you guys so much for listening. I apologize if this was a little bit rough. I'm still recovering from breaking my back in a car accident, and I'll be wearing this lovely back brace for the next 8 weeks. So if it sounds like it's hard for me to breathe, it's because it is. But thank you for bearing with me, and I love you guys. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and I will see you next week. Bye.
Thank you.